A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's genuinely unsettling when you sit with it. The core question is, what if Iran isn't keeping its enriched uranium in the sites we all know about? Natanz, Isfahan, Fort Owow. You can pull up satellite imagery of these places on social media in under 3 minutes. The prompt asks us to consider something more logical from a regime survival standpoint, a distributed nodal network. Take the stockpile, split it into small quantities, stash it in basements across dozens of cities, university chemistry labs, industrial facilities, places nobody would think to look. And the disturbing part is, given the physical form enriched uranium can take after conversion from gas, this isn't even technically implausible. So there are two questions here. First, what detection methods has the IAEA actually relied on when it's found undeclared sites before? And second, is this scenario something analysts are discussing and planning for? Because if it's even remotely plausible, it transforms the problem from striking a known target into something vastly more complicated.
The factual basis first, because that's where this lives or dies. The IAEA's primary tool for detecting undeclared nuclear activities isn't satellite imagery, and it isn't tip-offs from intelligence agencies, though both play a role. The workhorse is environmental sampling, specifically swipe sampling. Inspectors take what looks like a small cotton cloth, wipe it across surfaces inside a facility, seal it in a bag, and send it to the IAEA's clean lab in Cybersdorf, Austria. They also have a network of stations that sample air, water, soil, and vegetation around nuclear sites. What they're looking for are microscopic particles of uranium. We're talking particles smaller than a micrometer, invisible to the naked eye. The lab uses secondary ion mass spectrometry and fission track analysis to detect individual particles and determine their isotopic composition. This is how they caught Iran at the Calais Electric Company site in 2003. Iran had razed the building, removed the topsoil, laid new concrete. They literally demolished and rebuilt the site, thinking they'd destroyed all evidence. The IAEA found uranium particles anyway. Enriched uranium particles.
They scraped a wall and found what bulldozers missed.
And it gets more remarkable. In 2018 and 2019, the IAEA detected man-made uranium particles at a site in Turksabad, which is a district of Tehran, not a declared nuclear facility at all. Iran claimed the particles came from contaminated equipment that had been moved there, but the isotopic signatures told a different story. Then, in 2022, the IAEA found uranium particles enriched to 83.7% at Fort Dow, which was supposed to be capped at 60% under the JCPOA. The point is, these detection methods are extraordinarily sensitive. A single microscopic particle can unravel a cover story.
The question becomes whether a distributed network of small stockpiles would still leave a detectable trail. If you've got uranium metal or uranium oxide powder sitting in a university basement, does it shed particles into the environment that the IAEA could pick up?
This is where we need to get specific about the form factor, which the prompt alluded to. Enriched uranium hexafluoride, that's the gas form used in centrifuges, is highly reactive with moisture in the air. It forms uranyl fluoride particles, which are detectable. But once you convert it to uranium dioxide or uranium metal, the material is much more stable and less prone to shedding. Uranium metal is actually quite dense and not particularly dusty unless you're machining it. If you took the stockpile, converted it to metal, and stored it as sealed ingots or small solid forms in multiple locations, the environmental signature would be dramatically reduced. Not zero. Nothing is ever zero, but significantly harder to detect through routine environmental monitoring.
The IAEA's best tool might not work against this scenario.
It would be severely degraded, and that's before we even get to the question of access. The IAEA can only take environmental samples at sites it has access to. Under the additional protocol, which Iran signed but never ratified into law, the IAEA can request access to undeclared sites on short notice. Iran has consistently resisted these requests. The Turkzabad site I mentioned? Iran denied access for over a year. When inspectors finally got in, they found the site had been sanitized. They still found the particles. But imagine trying to do that across dozens of locations simultaneously. You can't.
Of course you can't. The IAEA has roughly 250 inspectors for the entire world. They're not raiding 40 university basements in a week.
And this is what makes the distributed network scenario so troubling. It exploits the fundamental asymmetry of nuclear verification. The IAEA is a small organization with limited resources. It relies heavily on member state cooperation and intelligence sharing. A determined state with a large territory, a lot of industrial and academic infrastructure, and a willingness to compartmentalize can make verification extraordinarily difficult. This isn't hypothetical. North Korea has been doing a version of this for decades.
Let's talk about North Korea as a case study, because I think it illuminates something important. How much of their program do we actually know the location of?
We know Yongbyon. We know the centrifuge hall they showed to Siegfried Hecker in 2010, and Hecker himself said he was stunned because he had no idea it existed before he walked into it. That facility was built in secret, inside a mountain, and it was operational for years before anyone outside North Korea confirmed it. There are believed to be at least one other centrifuge facility, possibly at Kangsan, but the intelligence community has debated this for years. We don't know for certain. And North Korea is a much smaller country than Iran, with far less industrial infrastructure. Iran has over 80 universities, dozens of industrial parks, a massive network of underground tunnels and bunkers developed over decades. The surface area for concealment is enormous.
The mountain centrifuge hall is basically the nightmare scenario. You build it, you operate it, and nobody outside knows it exists until you choose to show it to them.
Iran has been studying North Korea's playbook for years. The Fordow facility itself is built inside a mountain near Qom. It was constructed in secret, and Iran only declared it after Western intelligence agencies discovered it. The original plan was clearly to keep it hidden. So the regime understands the value of concealment and compartmentalization.
Which brings us to the second part of the prompt. Is this distributed network scenario something that's actually being discussed and planned for in intelligence and policy circles?
I've seen analysis from the Institute for Science and International Security, from David Albright's team, that explicitly models dispersed stockpile scenarios. The Pentagon's own assessments, going back to at least the early 2000s, have considered the possibility that Iran could maintain undeclared nuclear materials at multiple locations. The term that comes up is creep-out, a scenario where Iran doesn't conduct a visible breakout at a known facility, but rather gradually accumulates enough fissile material across multiple undeclared sites to eventually weaponize. The Israeli intelligence community has been particularly focused on this. There was a Mossad operation in 2018, the seizure of the nuclear archive from a warehouse in Tehran, that revealed Iran had been conducting research on weaponization components, including neutron initiators and high-explosive lensing, at sites that were not declared to the IAEA. The archive itself was stored in a nondescript warehouse in a Tehran industrial district, no visible security, nothing that would draw attention.
The archive was basically a distributed node already, just for documents rather than material.
And the documents themselves revealed that the weaponization work, Project Ahmad, had been conducted at multiple sites, many of which were not known to Western intelligence before the archive seizure. The Parchin military complex was one, but there were others. The Lavizan Shion site, the Talagon facility. Some of these had been raised and rebuilt, like Kalaye Electric. The pattern is clear: Iran distributes, conceals, and sanitizes. It's not a theoretical concern, it's their documented operating procedure.
If the distributed stockpile scenario is consistent with how they've operated for 20 years, the question becomes, what does a strike look like in this world? Because the current deterrence framework assumes you can credibly threaten to destroy the program. If there's no single program to destroy, what are you threatening?
This is the strategic problem. Has been developing the GBU-57, the massive ordnance penetrator, specifically to target deeply buried nuclear facilities like Fordow. The MLP can penetrate up to 200 feet of reinforced concrete before detonating. It's designed for the entombed, hardened, single-site scenario. Against a network of 40 basements and warehouses, it's useless. you'd need a ground invasion to secure all those sites, and even then, you'd need to know where they are. Intelligence is imperfect. The archive seizure was a triumph, but it was also a snapshot in time from 2003. Iran has had over 20 years since then to develop new sites.
The mop is basically a very expensive hammer for a problem that stopped being a nail.
The cost of that hammer. The GBU-57 program has run to over $300 million in development, is a rounding error compared to the strategic cost of the hammer no longer matching the problem.
Let's pull on the thread of the archive seizure a bit more. The warehouse in Tehran. This was in the Shorabad district, right? An industrial area. The Mossad team broke in, extracting something like 50,000 pages and 163 compact disks of documents, and got out without being detected. What does that tell us about the viability of a distributed network?
It tells us that Iran's approach to concealment is not always high-tech. The warehouse had no visible guards. It looked like a storage facility for old furniture. The archive was kept in filing cabinets and safes, but the building itself was unremarkable. This is actually a feature, not a bug. If you're hiding something, the best cover is ordinariness. A basement in a university chemistry department looks exactly like every other basement. An industrial unit in a business park looks like every other unit. You don't need armed guards and blast doors if nobody knows to look.
The archive documents showed that the weaponization work had been split across multiple teams, many of whom didn't know what the other teams were doing.
Classic intelligence tradecraft. The physicists working on neutron initiation didn't necessarily know the metallurgists working on the warhead casing. The procurement network didn't know what the components were for. This is hard to sustain at scale, but it's doable, and Iran has been doing it for decades. The distributed stockpile scenario would just apply the same principle to the fissile material itself.
We've got a regime that's demonstrated it can compartmentalize research, conceal facilities, sanitize sites, and maintain a nuclear program across multiple undeclared locations for decades. The idea that they would concentrate their entire enriched uranium stockpile in a couple of known sites, sites whose coordinates are publicly available, seems almost insultingly naive.
And yet the public debate often treats Natanz and Fordow as if they contain the entire program. A strike on Natanz is discussed as if it would end the nuclear threat. But Natanz is a known entity. It's been inspected, it's been sabotaged. Stuxnet, the 2020 centrifuge explosion, the 2021 power outage. Iran knows these sites are vulnerable. Why would they put everything there?
The other piece of this that the prompt raises is the assembly question. If you've got enriched uranium distributed across 20 locations, can you actually assemble a weapon from that? Or does the distributed network create its own logistical problems?
This is a real constraint, and it's worth taking seriously. Assembling a nuclear weapon is not like putting together IKEA furniture. You need specialized equipment, high-precision machining tools for the uranium metal components, a casting furnace, a controlled atmosphere environment to prevent oxidation. You need the high-explosive lensing system, which requires precision manufacturing and testing. You need the neutron initiator. These are not things you can do in a basement chemistry lab. So a distributed stockpile network would need a centralized assembly capability somewhere. The question is whether that assembly site could be concealed or whether it would be detectable.
The answer is probably that it depends on how much time you're willing to take. If you're not in a hurry, you could assemble slowly, in pieces, across multiple locations.
That's the creep-out scenario. You don't assemble a weapon in a week. You gradually build the components over years, at different sites, and bring them together only at the final stage. The final assembly might take place in a facility that looks like a conventional industrial plant, operating for only a few weeks before the weapon is complete. The window for detection becomes very narrow.
Let's go back to the IAEA detection question for a moment, because I want to understand what the real-world track record is. How many undeclared sites has the IAEA actually found in Iran, and how did they find them?
The IAEA has identified at least 4 undeclared sites in Iran where nuclear activities or materials were present. The Kalai Electric Company workshop, which I mentioned, that was discovered through environmental sampling and intelligence tip-offs. The Lavizan Shian site, Iran raised it and removed topsoil before inspectors could access it, but environmental samples taken from the surrounding area detected enriched uranium particles. The Parchin Military Complex. The IAEA had long suspected weaponization work there, but Iran denied access for years. When inspectors finally got in during 2015, they found evidence of a chamber designed for high explosives testing, though Iran had attempted to sanitize the site, and Terpsabad, where uranium particles were found in 2019.
In every case, the detection involved a combination of intelligence tip-offs and environmental sampling. The IAEA didn't just stumble upon these sites during routine inspections of declared facilities.
And this is a crucial point. The IAEA's verification system is designed primarily to verify the correctness and completeness of a state's declarations. It's not designed to be a search and discover operation across an entire country. The additional protocol strengthens the IAEA's ability to access undeclared sites, but it's still not a comprehensive search capability. The IAEA depends on member states to provide intelligence about suspicious sites. Without those tip-offs, many undeclared activities would likely go undetected.
Which means that against a distributed network of small stockpiles, the IAEA's detection capability is only as good as the intelligence it receives. And intelligence is imperfect.
Intelligence is very imperfect. The archive seizure was a once-in-a-generation intelligence coup. It revealed sites that had been unknown for over 15 years. How many other sites are there that we still don't know about? The honest answer is that nobody knows with certainty. Intelligence community has been surprised by nuclear programs repeatedly. India in 1974, Pakistan in the 1980s, North Korea's centrifuge program in 2010, the full scope of Iran's weaponization research. The track record of detecting covert nuclear activities is not encouraging.
There's a deeper point here that I think gets missed in a lot of the commentary. The distributed network scenario isn't just a technical challenge for detection, it's a strategic challenge for deterrence. If you can't locate the stockpile, you can't credibly threaten to destroy it. And if you can't credibly threaten to destroy it, what does deterrence look like?
It looks a lot more like Cold War deterrence than counterproliferation. You're no longer trying to prevent the weapon from existing. You're trying to deter its use after it exists. That's a fundamentally different strategic posture, and it's one that the EU has not fully adapted to in the Iran context. The policy framework is still largely built around prevention, sanctions, sabotage, the threat of military strikes. But if the stockpile is already distributed and concealed, prevention may have already failed. We just don't know it yet.
That's the uncomfortable possibility, that the distributed network doesn't need to be built. It may already exist, and we wouldn't know.
The prompt asks whether this is being planned for. I think the answer is yes, but the planning is difficult and incomplete. Military has certainly war game scenarios involving dispersed nuclear assets. Central Command and the Israel Defense Forces have conducted joint exercises that include elements of this problem, but wargaming a problem and solving it are different things. The fundamental challenge is that you can't bomb what you can't find, and you can't find what's been deliberately concealed across a country of 88 million people with massive industrial and academic infrastructure.
There's also a diplomatic dimension. The current framework for negotiating with Iran assumes there's a program you can verify and constrain. The JCPOA was built around limits on centrifuges, enrichment levels, and stockpile size at declared sites. If a significant portion of the program is undeclared and distributed, the entire verification framework becomes hollow. You're negotiating over the visible tip of the iceberg while the bulk of it sits unseen below the waterline.
This was always the critique of the JCPOA from the Israeli perspective, and it's worth taking seriously regardless of where you land on the deal's overall merits. The agreement provided for robust inspections of declared sites, but the mechanism for accessing undeclared sites was weaker, a 24-day notification period during which Iran could theoretically sanitize a site. And as we've seen, even trace particles can be removed or obscured if you have enough time and motivation.
The 24-day window was basically a cleanup clause.
It was heavily criticized for exactly that reason. The IAEA's own former deputy director, Olli Heininen, said that 24 days was enough to remove evidence of low-level enrichment activities. For higher-level activities, the evidence is harder to erase. Uranium particles tend to persist in the environment, but it's not impossible, especially if you've designed the site from the start to be easily sanitized.
Let's talk about the material form again, because I think this is the detail that makes the distributed scenario more plausible than people realize. Once you convert uranium hexafluoride gas to uranium metal or uranium oxide, what's the actual storage footprint?
This is where the physics gets uncomfortably helpful for concealment. The critical mass of uranium-235 metal is about 52 kilograms. That's for a bare sphere without a reflector. With a neutron reflector, you can get that down to about 15 kilograms. For a weapon, you need roughly 20 to 25 kilograms of highly enriched uranium, depending on the design sophistication. 25 kilograms of uranium metal is a sphere about the size of a grapefruit. It weighs about as much as a medium-sized dog. You could carry it in a backpack. Now, Iran's stockpile isn't all weapon grade. They've been enriching to 60%, which is a short step from 90%. But the physical form factor is similar. Enriched uranium oxide powder is even easier to store. It's a dense, dark powder that looks like nothing special. A few kilograms in a sealed container fit under a lab bench.
We're not talking about needing a warehouse. We're talking about a broom closet.
For a single warhead's worth of material, yes. For a larger stockpile, you'd need more space, but it's still not a massive footprint. Iran's total enriched uranium stockpile, as of the most recent IAEA report, was estimated at over 5,000 kilograms of uranium enriched to various levels, but the highly enriched component is smaller. If you converted the 60% material to metal and distributed it, you're talking about dozens of relatively small packages that could be stored in locations nobody would ever look.
The grapefruit comparison is chilling. Most people picture nuclear material as something that requires a massive industrial facility to store. The reality is that the physics doesn't demand that. The security demands it if you want to protect it from theft. But if your goal is concealment rather than security, the physics is almost cooperative.
This is the paradox of nuclear materials. They're simultaneously some of the most dangerous substances on Earth and, in physical form, surprisingly compact and manageable. The engineering challenge is in the enrichment and weaponization, not in the storage. Once you've solved the hard problems, hiding the material is relatively straightforward.
Where does this leave us? The prompt asks two questions. What detection methods has the IAEA relied on? And is the distributed network scenario being discussed and planned for? We've answered the first, environmental sampling, intelligence tip-offs, and a verification system that's strong on declared sites, but weak on undeclared ones. For the second, the answer seems to be yes, it's being discussed, but the planning is constrained by the fundamental asymmetry. The hider has an enormous advantage over the seeker.
I'd add one more layer. There's a third question implied in the prompt, which is, if the distributed network scenario is plausible, what should we be doing differently? And I think the honest answer involves several things. First, intelligence collection needs to prioritize detection of small-scale, distributed activities, not just large visible facilities. This means human intelligence, signals intelligence, and supply chain monitoring. Second, the diplomatic framework needs to account for the possibility that declared sites don't represent the full program. Third, the military planning needs to go beyond the MOP and single-site strike scenarios. And fourth, the public debate needs to catch up to the reality. Too much of the conversation still treats Natanz and Fordow as if they're the whole story.
The public debate point is well taken. I think most people, if you ask them where Iran's nuclear program is, would name Natanz and maybe Fordow. The idea that there could be material in a university basement in Isfahan or a storage unit in Tehran doesn't enter the conversation, and that's exactly the kind of blind spot a distributed network exploits.
It's not just Iran. This is a generic vulnerability in the non-proliferation regime. The entire verification system was designed in a different era for a different threat model. It assumes states will declare their facilities and that verification is about checking the declarations. It's not built for a world where determined proliferators actively conceal and distribute their programs. North Korea exploited this. Iran is exploiting it. Future proliferators will too.
Every news article about Natanz, every satellite image analysis thread on social media, every public discussion of airstrike options, it's all reinforcing the logic of distribution.
If you're sitting in Tehran and you see the entire world staring at your declared sites, the rational move is to make those sites less important. Move the material, spread it out, make the visible targets hollow. That's not paranoia, it's basic strategic thinking.
The Archide seizure showed they understand this at an operational level. The most sensitive documents in their nuclear program were stored not in a fortress, but in a nondescript warehouse. The security was obscurity, not fortification.
Which worked for years. The Mossad found it because they had extraordinary intelligence, human sources likely. Without that, the warehouse might still be sitting there unnoticed. How many other warehouses, basements, and lab storage rooms are sitting unnoticed right now?
That's the question that keeps analysts up at night. And it's not a question with a satisfying answer.
No, it's not. But I think it's better to ask the question honestly than to pretend the known sites represent the full picture. Strategic surprise happens when you assume your adversary is cooperating with your mental model of them. Iran has repeatedly demonstrated that they will not cooperate with our mental model. They will hide things, sanitize sites, compartmentalize, and distribute. Assuming they'll suddenly stop doing that and concentrate everything in a few known buildings is not a serious basis for policy.
Covering the covers. We spend so much time analyzing the known sites that we're effectively covering the story of the known sites. But the real story might be the distributed network we're not covering. We're covering the covers.
The visible program becomes a decoy, intentional or not, that absorbs analytical attention while the real stockpile sits elsewhere.
Let's pull one more thread before we wrap. The prompt mentioned the possibility of assembling a warhead from a distributed stockpile. I want to be precise about what that would actually require. Is it technically feasible to bring together components from multiple locations and assemble a functional weapon in a short time frame?
It depends on the weapon design and the level of pre-assembly. For a gun-type weapon, the simplest design, what was used on Hiroshima, the assembly is relatively straightforward. You need two subcritical pieces of highly enriched uranium that are brought together rapidly in a gun barrel. If the uranium components have been pre-machined to the correct specifications, final assembly could be done in a matter of days or even hours in a facility that looks like a conventional machine shop. The more challenging design is the implosion weapon, which requires precision high-explosive lenses. That's harder to distribute and assemble quickly. But Iran's weaponization research, as revealed in the archive, focused on implosion, specifically a design for a warhead that could fit on a Shahab 3 missile, so they've been working on the harder path.
Which suggests a certain level of sophistication and ambition.
And it means that the final assembly step would likely require a centralized facility with specialized equipment. But that facility could be small, could be concealed, and could operate for only a very short period. The distributed stockpile feeds the assembly site, which only exists as a nuclear facility for the brief window of final integration. Before and after that window, it's just an industrial building.
The detection window for the assembly phase is potentially very narrow. Days or weeks, not months or years.
Which makes it an extremely hard intelligence target. You're not looking for a permanent facility with visible signatures. You're looking for a temporary activity at an unknown location that will only be active for a short period. That's needle in a haystack territory.
This has been thoroughly unsettling. Let me try to summarize where I think we've landed. The IAEA's primary detection method for undeclared activities is environmental sampling, swipe samples, and environmental monitoring that can detect microscopic uranium particles. It's extraordinarily sensitive, but it's not a comprehensive search capability. It depends on access and intelligence tip-offs. Against a distributed network of small stockpiles, particularly if the material is in a stable form like uranium metal or oxide, the environmental signature would be significantly reduced, and the IAEA simply doesn't have the resources to search an entire country.
On the second question, yes, the distributed network scenario is being discussed in intelligence and policy circles. It's not a fringe theory. It's consistent with Iran's documented operating procedures, compartmentalization, concealment, sanitization. The strategic implications are profound because it undermines both the verification framework and the military options that have been the backbone of counterproliferation policy. The hider has a structural advantage over the seeker, and Iran has been exploiting that advantage for over two decades.
The one thing I'd add is that none of this means the distributed network definitely exists. It means it's plausible, it's consistent with what we know, and it would be strategically rational from Iran's perspective. But the burden of proof shouldn't be on proving it exists. Given the track record, the burden should be on proving it doesn't.
That's an inversion of how the verification system currently works. The system assumes declarations are complete until evidence proves otherwise. In Iran's case, there's ample evidence that declarations have been incomplete, repeatedly. Adjusting the assumption might be the most important thing we can do.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1860s, roughly 90% of the population on New Zealand's South Island spoke a language with ergative case marking, primarily dialects of Maori, making it one of the most densely ergative-speaking regions in the world at that time.
I have no follow-up questions.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want more episodes, find us at myweirdprompts.com or on Spotify. We'll be back soon. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.